Chapter 19. "Can someone please explain to me what just happened?" Deputy Administrator Baterna Logelia asked her staff in exasperation. She knew she was being unfair to her dedicated people. The Chief Administrator's office had shouted at her moments ago, so she was shouting at her staffers. They would shout at their own teams in turn all the way down, and no one knew anything useful. "You." She pointed at her military liaison, who was engaged in an animated conversation through an earpiece in his right ear and had a second phone held up to his left ear. "Why and how did we fire on those Kristang ships?" The ceasefire had been thoroughly and very effectively broken. After jumping away, Admiral Kikrondo of the Kristang had warned of severe consequences from the remaining ships in his still-dangerous task force. The man lowered the phone from his left ear.
"Pardon me, Administrator Logelia. We did not fire on the Kristang."
"I know that we didn't," she tried to control her anger. The military had taken rash action that put at risk the civilian population, people she was responsible for.
"Commodore Ferlant, it was not Commodore Ferlant," the liaison officer stated firmly. "I received a message from his executive officer a moment ago. They were as surprised as we were. The Commodore has no idea who fired. In fact, he accused us of doing something that he considers to be incredibly stupid."
"Well," Baterna threw up her hands in exasperation, "the planet didn't shoot at the Kristang by itself."
"No, clearly," he agreed. "They were projectors, powerful maser cannons."
"I know what a projector is, Sleen," she used the man's surname.
"Whose projectors, if not ours?"
She knew one thing for damn sure. The Ruhar government had never installed projectors on Gitanu. There was no way such a monumental effort could have been concealed.
"It had to be the Kristang, ma'am, before we first came to Gitanu. Somehow,"
it was his turn to throw up his hands,
"someone activated them. 4 projectors at least, by our last count."
But Turner's head was spinning.
"You think they have been buried here, practically beneath our feet, all this time?"
"That is the only explanation we can think of currently," Sleen responded somewhat distractedly. He was listening to another, or several other, conversations in his earpiece.
"Now that we know what these projectors look like, we should surely be able to scan for them, can't we? We must understand what we are dealing with, and who caused those projectors to fire without our authority."
"Yes, ma'am, we can scan, but the projectors are likely concealed by a stealth field and other countermeasures. That is why we never detected them before."
"We weren't looking before," Baterna said hopefully. "We must immediately begin to scan the subsurface for—"
"Excuse me, ma'am,
but we will not be able to spare any aircraft for scanning projectors or even to investigate and secure the 4 we know of. Administrator, please come with me. We need to get you to safety."
"Why?" She did not budge from behind her desk.
"The Kristang have gone." She pointed to the ceiling. "Their ships are gone for the moment, yes. Administrator, we are faced with an almost unique military situation. With neither side having ships in orbit, combat aircraft become the most powerful means of securing control of this planet. I was just informed that the Kristang have launched waves of aircraft targeting our own airfields. The situation is very dangerous."
"We must be responding with our own aircraft."
"Yes, ma'am," Selene said, gesturing for the administrator's personal security team to hustle her away to an air raid shelter. "No one has fought for a pure air battle like this in several generations. Unfortunately, ma'am, we are about to see firsthand whether all of our theories of air combat strategy are worth the training time we invested. I suggest you be someplace safe when theory meets reality."
Baterna nodded, accepting the pleading look from her personal security team.
"Very well. In my experience, Mr. Sleen, whenever theory meets reality, theory loses."
"Yes, ma'am," the military liaison officer agreed, and turned his attention to coordinating crisis response teams. For this was certainly a crisis. For the initial wave of air attacks by the Kristang, they quickly launched dropships to fly high cover and provide the massed aircraft below with long-range sensor and targeting data. With laser links between the attacking aircraft and the 3 dropships, the attackers could stand off at a safe distance and launch missiles at well-defended targets. Once the Ruhar defenses were degraded, the aircraft could fly in to attack their primary targets. The 3 dropships were perfectly positioned for their role in the attack. They had climbed high, so their sensors swept the area between the Kristang aircraft and the Ruhar airbase,
and with their active sensors able to detect a rough location for even stealth Ruhar aircraft, the Kristang aircraft were able to hug the terrain at low altitude and remain in stealth. Because dropships could climb above an atmosphere, they could not be effectively engaged by aircraft, so the Ruhar had to send their own very limited number of dropships to counter the Kristang. At the start of this massive air battle, the Ruhar were at a serious disadvantage in combat power. Until the Kristang battle group arrived, the Ruhar had assumed their defensive needs could be handled by Commodore Ferlant's small task force. The Ruhar federal government had not wanted to ship combat aircraft and dropships all the way to a remote planet they intended to leave. Most of the combat air power the Ruhar had at the start of the air battle was left over from when humans had used them during the evacuation. Due to need for regular maintenance on the worn-out aircraft and lack of spare parts, 30% of the Ruhar's combat aircraft were unavailable when the Kristang launched their attack. Thanks to Skippy, we had a complete view of the developing air battle that would become known among humans as the Great Paradise Furball. With hundreds of aircraft tangling in intense dogfights, it was like a ball of fur rolling around and around in the sky. The Ruhar and Kristang had similar names for the battle, and no one involved ever forgot a single detail. The first shot in the Great Paradise Furball wasn't fired by the Kristang or the Ruhar. It was fired by a shiny beer can. Those three dropships looked like trouble to me. While I wasn't a fighter pilot, my infantry experience had taught me the value of high ground, and those dropships had the high ground. Skippy, can you do something about those three dropships?
Yeah, I got it, Joe. No problemo.
No problem. You told us that each projector can only cover 28% of the sky from its position, I reminded our smart-ass AI.
28% on a projector's normal settings, Joe. I am going to cheat.
Of course you are. I rolled my eyes. Please, O greatest of great ones, allow us mere mortals a glimpse into your awesomely wondrous plan.
Oh, I like that. Damn, Joe, that almost sounded sincere.
From now on, I'm going to make you monkeys address me that way when you want something, like me programming the jump drive.
That sounds like an excellent deal, Skippy, and from now on, I'm going to move you from your personal escape pod man cave to a little basket on the side of the toilet next to the galley.
On second thought, Joe, you can just keep calling me Skippy the Magnificent. How about Asshole Almighty?
I'm sure we can reach a compromise somewhere in there, Joe.
I'm sure we can. Is this where you're going to warp space-time to bend the maser beam or something like that?
No, Joe, I am not going to bend a beam of light, you moron. I can only do that over longer ranges, and I can't wrap space-time so close to an inhabited planet. That's too dangerous. Do you want to hear what I'm going to do?
No. You talk too freaking long, Skippy. I pointed to the display with symbols for the dropships, which were now at about their maximum altitude. They were about to launch missiles at a Ruhar airbase.
We don't have time for talk. You need to show me.
Skippy did show me, and I would give that show a 5 out of 5 in terms of entertainment. The Kristang dropship pilots didn't leave a review after the action because they were, dead. I'm thinking their review would not have been 5 stars. The three dropships very reasonably thought they were safe from attack by projectors. The dropships were at high altitude, higher than an aircraft could fly, but not so high that they were above the atmosphere. The dropships were to the south of the direct path from the Kristang airbase to their Ruhar targets. Going to the south brought them out of the targeting cones of the 4 projectors they knew about. The dropship pilots were aware that they were being used as bait to determine whether we had projectors we hadn't used yet. Still, they surely must have thought they were safe from being struck by the 4 projectors they knew about. They should have been safe. They did not know about Skippy.
Hey, Skippy, I pointed at the display. Those dropships are in stealth. How can you determine their position closely enough to target them?
Simple, Joey. I asked them to tell me.
Huh?
Following standard Kristang practice, those dropships are sharing data with a tight beam laser link. That allows them to, for one thing, avoid crashing into each other while they are in stealth. The problem for them is that while the laser beam is narrow, it does bounce off air molecules, and because I am the all-seeing Skippy the Magnificent, I can tell exactly where those ships are. Now, shut up for a minute and let me do my thing.
Skippy, being the genius that he is, he was able to make the projectors do things they had not been designed to do. When the projectors had been installed, they were lowered into the ground in one piece, and then motorized magnetic pistons were attached to aim the beam. Skippy made some of those pistons retract to their original position way down in the hole where they had been before explosive charges blew away the dirt over the buried projectors, and the business end of the projector's muzzle was extended above the surface. With the set of pistons off balance, the beam projector was knocked to one side. Knocked to the side toward the three Krestang dropships. That still wasn't enough of an angle to bring those dropships directly into the targeting cone, so Skippy used another trick. He defocused the beam. Normally, you want a microwave laser beam to be as narrow as possible so it can put all of its power on one target, so it can slice an armored starship in half, for example. Skippy fired the projector on low power in a series of broad pulses, more like a flashlight than a thin beam. The maser pulses scorched a broad area of the air as they traveled through the atmosphere, scorched the air enough that the dropships, which were at high altitude but still within the atmosphere, were suddenly subjected to extreme overheating as the air around them was converted into plasma. The air around them briefly became like the photosphere of a star, and backscatter from the defocused maser pulses reflecting off air molecules struck the dropships directly. In less than a second, the extreme heat caused the dropship power cells, missiles, and warheads to explode. "Did that do the job, Joe?" Skippy asked. "Let's see. There were three dropships up there, and now I count... not three. No, not two either, or one. I count zero dropships. Zero is less than three, right, Joey?" "Let me kick my boots off so I can count on my toes, Skippy. I am a dumb monkey, remember?" "Okay, I think we're good. Unless you consider disorganized pieces falling toward the ground as a dropship." "No. You did it. Thank you, Skippy." "You're not thanking me on behalf of those dropship pilots, are you, Joe? Because if you're hoping to get a fruit basket from them, you will be waiting a while." "Wow," I whispered. "That's a whole lot of aircraft." On the dropship's display was a total view of the developing air battle, or I should say battles. There were seven distinct clusters of aircraft approaching each other at high speed, and as I watched, the fighters on both sides began turning to maneuver to gain an advantage. Thanks to the magic of Skippy the Magnificent, I had perfect situational awareness of every aspect of the battles, even though almost all of the aircraft was still in stealth mode. "Yep," Skippy agreed. "This is going to be quite some show. There hasn't been an aircraft campaign like this in a very long time. Although perhaps campaign isn't the correct word, since I expect this whole thing to be over in a couple hours, max. Joe, do you want to grab some popcorn and watch the show in real time?" "No, Skippy, I do not want any popcorn." I was angry at his insensitivity. "It is not a show. This is real air combat. People are going to die. You may be immortal. The rest of us are not." "Joe, I am terribly sorry," Skippy said, and this time he sounded sincere. "You are right. I should not have said that. It was insensitive. You are a pilot now and a soldier. I should have considered that." "Apology accepted, Skippy," which were words that I never thought I would ever be able to say. "Skippy apologizing? Is there anything we can do?" Already I could see aircraft on both sides firing masers at long range. They weren't likely to hit anything. The point was to keep the enemy at long range. Keep the enemy from closing on you until you wanted them closer on your terms. With the aircraft of both the Ruha and Krestang using stealth fields to confuse enemy sensors, defensive shields to deflect maser beams, and maser turrets to destroy incoming missiles, aircraft couldn't rely on fire-and-forget missiles like the U.S. Air Force did on Earth. Air combat in the war between the Ruha and Krestang was a close-range affair like World War II. Get close to the enemy aircraft, hammer it with maser pulses to degrade its shields, then finish it with a volley of missiles. Thinking about it, I shuddered. What I knew about flying was strictly peacetime maneuvers. I would hate to be in the skies above paradise right then. "Anything we can do?" "You mean, is there anything I can do?" "Sure, Joe, there is a lot I can do. It would surprise me if we got permission to do much of it." "You? Since when do you ask permission to do anything?" "Well, by we, I meant you, Joe. And by permission, I meant an okay from Count Chocula." Oh, shit. I'd almost forgotten that nagging little detail. Most of the things I could do that would be effective in giving the Ruha an advantage over the Krestang would risk being too obvious. The Krestang would figure out that some higher technology had been messing with the aircraft. Exactly. What's worse is that the Ruha would review the after-action sensor data and realize someone else was messing with the Kristang. The Ruha would logically conclude that the Jirapatha must have been involved on their side, but when they inevitably ask the Jirapatha about it, the Jirapatha will certainly know they didn't help in the air battle, and that will start the Jirapatha asking uncomfortable questions and looking into things that are better left alone. I can see that would be a problem. That reminds me of something that has been troubling me for some time, Joe. The Theranin are not stupid. Their intelligence people surely by now have heard a rumor about a human escaping from a Kristang jail, and that same human stealing a Ruha Dodo. The Dodo was taken aboard a Kristang frigate, and both that frigate and its star carrier mothership disappeared without a trace. I am surprised that the Theranin have not been investigating the accident. Or maybe they are, and we don't know it yet. Shit, Skippy, that's not good. It is most certainly not good at all, Joe. Which is why we must avoid any significant risk of me interfering in the battle to help the Ruhar in any way that looks suspicious. Count Chocula is annoyingly correct about that. We can't risk exposing our presence. Crap. Turn the display off, Skippy. I don't want to watch this slaughter. Wait. Joe, I said that I can't do anything obvious. I didn't say that I couldn't do anything at all. Come on, Joe, it's Skippy the Magnificent you're talking to here. Trust the awesomeness. Trust the awesomeness. Will that be a new slogan? In spite of the situation, I had to laugh. On the display, aircraft were tangling in the most gigantic air battle I had ever imagined. The Ruha were outnumbered. What type of awesomeness do you have in mind, Skippy? It was probably too late to request permission from Chotek. This was definitely an act now and ask forgiveness later kind of situation. You know how the Kristang are bad at taking proper care of maintenance on their equipment because they consider that to be an inglorious task unfitting for warriors? Well, there are times when such lack of attention to detail can bite you in the ass. This is one of those times. Skippy, are you doing something now without getting permission? I have no idea what you're talking about, Joe. Of course not. I rolled my eyes. Let me ask it this way. If you were doing something, what might that be? Oh, well, speaking hypothetically, it is possible that the Kristang aircraft are experiencing intermittent glitches in their networked fire control systems. These glitches are degrading their already crappy sensor capabilities. And, in an ironic coincidence, at the same time the Kristang are having glitches in their systems, the Ruha aircraft have received an awesome software upgrade that they don't know about. This upgrade enhances the effectiveness of their stealth capabilities. The combined effect of these two totally unrelated coincidences is that the Ruhar have a significant advantage in air combat. Their aircraft can engage at longer ranges, while the Kristang have to fly relatively close to get a weapons lock on the Ruhar. Cool, hypothetically. Not as cool as I would like it to be, Joe. Ordinarily, this would mean the Ruhar are able to engage and disengage from combat at will. With that many aircraft tangling across the sky, they are so mixed up that the initial advantage of the Ruha has been diminished. At this point, both sides are about even. The Ruha went into the fight at a disadvantage, Skippy. Making it an even fight is a great help. Thank you. Hypothetically, you are welcome. Oh, hey, if I forget, please remind me to wipe that software upgrade from the Ruha's systems after the battle is over. Joe, this is going to be a terrible slaughter on both sides. The Ruhar have already lost 7% of their airworthy combat aircraft, plus another 12% that were destroyed on the ground. The Kristang have lost 11% total so far. Both sides are quickly discovering that their tactics for air combat do not apply for a battle of this size and scope. The pilots are having to make this up on the fly, no joke intended. Joe, this air battle is going to be studied for hundreds of years. I understand. After that, we watched the action unfurl across the display. Skippy had the good sense to keep quiet, except for quietly bringing particularly significant events to my attention. Mostly, I sat silently as symbols on the display flared and blinked out. When the Kristang had launched waves of aircraft to attack Ruhar air bases, Saley and Derek had been headed back toward their own base. Then Saley received an order to change course and fly low and slow for maximum stealth. Ruhar Air Command had judged that Saley was too far away to help prevent the initial attack on her own airbase, so she was being held in reserve to strike the Kristang aircraft on the way back to their own bases to rearm and refuel. Saley had shaken with anger at doing nothing, while enemy missiles blasted the airbase where her friends worked and lived. Though the Ruhar military data link was being partly jammed by the Kristang, and the enemy had already knocked out many of the transmitters, the tactical communications system was designed to operate under wartime conditions. Derek still had a full picture of the situation across the surface of Gitanu. He kept Saley informed of what she needed to know, and didn't mention details that would only upset and distract her. From her seat in the front of the tandem cockpit, she could call up any tactical data she wanted. She didn't have all that much to do while the Dobra flew in lazy circles to achieve maximum stealth. Flying low to the ground meant that the fighter's already tiny signature would be mostly lost in ground clutter to any active sensors above. Flying slowly meant the Dobra was not leaving a long trail of disturbed air behind it. And they were flying slowly enough that Saley had only one of the two engines active. The active engine was using only its electrically powered fan blades, and therefore not radiating much heat at all. Secure inside their stealth field, Saley and Derek waited for a signal from Air Command.
"Derek, Lieutenant Bansu," she addressed him by his human military rank. "We will be going into combat against the Kristang. We will be shooting directly at, killing, Kristang. This will be crossing a line. A human involved in hostile action against your patron species. I need to know if you have a problem with this. I need to know whether I can rely on you as my weapon systems officer."
"Yes," Derek responded immediately.
"Absolutely, 100%. I know what the Kristang did to my home planet."
Derek was among a growing percentage of humans on Paradise who feared the wormhole to Earth had been shut down deliberately by the Kristang to cover up what they were doing on that distant planet. Despite assurances from the Ruhar that the Kristang, nor the Theranin, nor even the Maxulks had the technology to control a wormhole, Derek thought it very suspicious that the only wormhole to humanity's home had shut down shortly after the Kristang lost control of Paradise. That could not be a coincidence. And if Derek could not do anything to directly help Earth, he could at least kill as many lizards as he could find in his weapons range. During the brief time when the Kristang battle group had total control around Paradise, Derek had feared he could never do anything to avenge the loss of his home world. Now, a miracle had cleared the skies of Kristang, and Derek Bansu was not going to miss this golden opportunity.
"Saley, you can absolutely count on me. Let's do this."
Following orders from Ruhar Air Command, Saley had kept the Dobra flying slow, lazy circles as the four Kristang aircraft flew by. As soon as the enemy passed overhead, Saley went to full power on the engines to close the distance. Saley still had the ship in stealth and was about to drop the stealth field for combat maneuvering when Derek had shouted over the intercom,
"Break right and cut power!"
Saley pulled the aircraft into a gentle turn and throttled back the engines. Before she could ask, Derek explained, "They can't see through our stealth field. I've been watching them ping us with targeting sensors and they can't get a lock. I have a perfect lock on that lead ship with the Mazer guidance system." Saley checked her instruments. Derek was right. The enemy's active sensors were still pinging blindly. They couldn't get a lock on the Dobra's position. In air combat, both sides enveloped their aircraft in stealth fields until they began maneuvering into attack position and firing. At that point, with the range between aircraft closing, the high speed leaving turbulent air behind, and the engines radiating heat, stealth gave no advantage. Except that now, somehow the Kristang were not able to lock onto the Dobra, and her aircraft was maintaining a perfect lock as if the Kristang did not have stealth capability at all. Saley did not wait to wonder at the unexpected circumstances. That was for the experts to puzzle over later when they viewed the flight recorder data.
"Missiles, full spread."
Derek toggled three missiles at the aircraft he had been intending to fire at with the Mazer cannon and another three at the aircraft's wingman. The six missiles dropped out of the back of the Dobra, ignited, and flew violently twisting evasive paths to their targets. With missiles in the air, Derek activated the Mazer to target the same two aircraft. He was not trying to kill with the Mazer. He only wanted the Mazer to confuse the enemy's sensors and prevent the enemy defense Mazers from hitting his missiles. He was only partly successful. The first aircraft's defenses exploded two missiles more than 10 kilometers away. Easy kills. But then its sensors seemed to go blind. The enemy fighter turned desperately as Derek watched his missile jinking side to side and up and down as it closed the distance. The enemy defensive Mazer turrets were not firing at all. They could not find a target to shoot at. Then the missile impacted the enemy directly, blowing it into pieces. The second aircraft shot down one incoming missile, and the other two were intermittently struck by defensive masers, but they were only glancing shots as the missiles quickly darted away. Both missiles flew by their evasive target, and their electronic brains concluded they did not have enough fuel to turn and re-engage the enemy. The brains also concluded they were close enough, so they both detonated their shape-charge fragmentation warheads toward the enemy. Pieces of warheads flew through the air on both sides of the enemy fighter, ripping into it and turning it into a fireball. Saley was stunned by the turn of events. In simulations, aircraft almost always were able to destroy incoming missiles with their defensive masers when missiles were launched at long range. It was only in the close quarters of a dogfight that missiles could home in before the enemy's defenses could knock them out. Yet here, now, she had fired missiles at two targets and destroyed both targets. The enemy still had not fired a shot at her, as they did not appear to be able to determine exactly where her Dobra was. Adapting quickly to the new reality, Saley maneuvered to maintain their distance to the two other enemy fighters. The enemy ruined her plan. They did not know why the Ruhar stealth field was so much more effective than they had expected, or what was wrong with their own targeting sensors. But they did know that if they let the Ruhar loiter at long range and fire missiles, they were both dead. So they pulled tight turns and went to full power, not caring whether they were that much more visible to the apparently superior Ruhar sensors. The range between the three combatants closed rapidly, and Saley was forced yet again to adapt. Derek Bonsu grunted from the strain in the back seat of the Dobra gunship as Saley pulled the fighter aircraft into another tight turn. The G-meter in front of him registered 8, and since gravity on the Ruhar homeworld was slightly higher than on Earth, it felt even heavier to Derek. Even in the advanced Ruhar flight suit he wore, his vision narrowed until all he could see was a small circle directly in front of his eyes. The Ruhar pilot was taking it easy on him, he knew. Genetically enhanced Ruhar pilots could sustain 12 Gs in combat turns. Having Derek as her Wizzo was actually a liability in air combat. Saley was endangering her own life and their mission in order to avoid killing her human co-pilot. The turn completed, the Dobra snapped back to a straight course, and Derek was thrown forward against the restraints as Saley cut power and the fighter decelerated rapidly. "Stealth field is nominal," Derek managed to grunt. His whole world was reduced to the display and controls directly in front of him. He still had no peripheral vision. The two enemy fighters were now again in front of them. "We have target lock on the left-hand ship," he gasped between sucking in oxygen. "Missiles?" "Do it," Saley ordered. They were now too close to the Kristang for stealth to be of much use, and the Dobra had 12 missiles left. As Derek toggled off 6 missiles, she felt the Dobra lurch slightly as the aircraft suddenly weighed less. On her own controls, she pressed the button to activate the Dobra's maser cannon. At the same time, her own ship rocked as an enemy maser hammered her shields. "Missiles inbound," Derek shouted. 10, 12, 14. "We can't track all of them," he warned. The enemy had dumped almost all of their missiles blindly into the air, and now that the Dobra was firing a maser at full power and its engines were glowing hot, the enemy missiles had a target to chase. "Saley, this is going to be close." The display for their defensive computer was flashing red warnings that it had lost track of some enemy missiles, and the defensive maser turrets could only engage 2 missiles at once. A Ruhar Dobra gunship had 2 escape systems for the crew. Because the Dobra was a high-performance jet fighter aircraft designed to operate at supersonic speed and extreme altitude, the crew simply opening the canopy and ejecting was not an option. Instead, the entire 2-person tandem cockpit could separate from the disintegrating airframe. Moments after their own missiles turned the 4th and last Kristang fighter into a ball of fire, an enemy missile had exploded close behind them. Shrapnel took out both engines, shattering fan blades and causing a power cell to rupture. Knowing her aircraft was doomed, Saley reached down on the right side of her seat and flipped a switch to retract a safety cover, then pressed the recessed button, saying a silent prayer that the cockpit separation mechanism was still operable. As her fingers fumbled with the switch, the flight control computer realized that the aircraft was no longer a viable flying device and handed off control to the cockpit separation computer. That computer had been waiting for the flight control computer to make the blindingly obvious decision while the airframe broke apart around it, so it immediately engaged the separation process even before it received input from the pilot. Saley tried to shout a warning to Derek in the seat behind her, but with holes in the canopy, the shrieking wind was too loud even to be heard in the helmet speakers. Derek must know what was happening. She only had a moment to think, and he should be preparing to use the secondary separation button if the separation control computer failed to or was unable. With a roar, she heard over the wind. Explosive bolts released the cockpit from its connection to the airframe, and a small rocket motor pushed the cockpit section upward. Because the Dobra was falling apart and tumbling out of control, the cockpit computer's pre-programmed maneuver to straighten out the cockpit's own tumble and make it fly directly upward was the wrong move. As the bottom of the cockpit cleared the top of the airframe well it had rested in, the left side of the cockpit was struck by debris from the exploding left engine. A fan blade penetrated the cockpit's armor and struck just behind Saley. When the cockpit was not more than 2 meters above its well, the suddenly unbalanced airframe flipped in an eye blink, and the tail of the aircraft smashed into the rear of the rising cockpit. Derek's helmet was secured to the seat to prevent a pilot's neck from snapping. That didn't stop his brain from being bounced around inside his skull from the violent battering of the separation. Less than 5 seconds had passed since he shouted the warning about missiles approaching. The cockpit separation had not surprised him, but he hadn't heard a warning from Saley. When the rocket motor kicked the cockpit upward, his right arm had been reaching down for the separation button, while his left arm was still on the control stick trying to maintain some semblance of control over the failing aircraft. Separation had caught him unawares, and his left arm ached as if it had torn loose at the shoulder. Then something, two somethings, struck the cockpit, and the whole cockpit section was suddenly tumbling through the air on its own. "Saley!" he shouted, doubting the pilot could hear him. Through the canopy, blue sky and green forest flashed by like a strobe light, so quickly was the cockpit spinning. Too low. They had been flying at around 900 kilometers per hour when the enemy missile exploded, but at less than 1,000 meters altitude. The cockpit should have stabilized, then released a steerable triangular parachute to set them down softly. Instead, all the displays were dark, and the cockpit was tumbling worse than the aircraft had been.
"Saley, we need to get out of here! Saley!"
There was no response from in front of him. Possibly the pilot was unconscious, although the genetically enhanced body of a Ruhar should have withstood the strain better than his own fragile human biology. Derek could have reached for the handle between his legs to eject his own seat. He was not leaving without the pilot. Without waiting any longer, Derek reached for the black and yellow striped handle in front of his seat, barely able to make his right arm extend that far. His left arm hung uselessly at his side. When he had a firm grip on the handle, he closed his eyes and pulled firmly. First, the canopy blew off. Then Derek's seat soared upward, propelled by a magnetic rail. He only felt the initial kick before he became unconscious. The seat ejection mechanism, designed for Ruhar, had not been reset for a human on that flight, a flight in which the Dobra was not supposed to have a human crewman, a flight that was supposed to have been a quick and simple check ride. As Derek's seat blew upward into the airstream, the final crew escape mechanism activated. The straps that held Derek into the chair automatically released, and he was exposed to the 500-kilometer-per-hour airstream. Before his limbs could be torn off by the force of the air and deceleration, a flexible tube that he wore on his back came to life, and he was enveloped in an oval-shaped bubble. The computer built into the tube bent and compressed the bubble to keep him upright, and he flew through the air. Once the computer decided his speed had dropped below a preset mark, the bubble disappeared as suddenly as it formed. Without the unconscious Derek doing anything or knowing what was happening, the nanofabric of the bubble retracted inside the flexible tube, and the nanofabric changed its shape in a microsecond. The top of the tube came off, and the fabric was yanked upward. It was now a parachute, or technically a paraglider. The computer activated its sensors. If the computer had been capable of emotion, it would have been greatly dismayed. It was too low, and the ground beneath was thickly covered with trees in every direction. There were no safe places to glide to within the paraglider's range. With an electronic shrug, the computer decided that crashing into one treetop was as good as another, and it concentrated on slowing its passengers' rate of descent. The paraglider reformed its shape from a wedge to a half sphere, and Derek was jolted again. Crashing down through the trees was no more gentle than what he had endured so far. With the parachute having lost lift, he fell straight down, bouncing off tree limbs and breaking branches. There was a final violent jolt as the parachute snagged on a tree limb, and he came to a stop 10 meters off the ground. The parachute computer, still active, calculated the distance, and the nanofabric of the parachute cords stretched to lower Derek almost gently to the ground. Satisfied that it had done all it could for the pilot, the parachute computer released the cords, and the pilot's bruised and battered body lay alone on the forest floor. Saley was not so lucky as Derek. The engine fan blade that struck the cockpit as they were separating penetrated the armor and a piece punctured the seat, damaging its release mechanism. When Derek pulled the handle to eject them from the cockpit, Saley's seat should have ejected first. Because the cockpit computer knew her seat was damaged, it delayed Saley's ejection until after Derek was clear. But as the then-empty cockpit tumbled violently, components broke off in the airstream and several pieces flew toward Saley. Right after she was released from the seat and the nanofabric began to blossom into a protective bubble around her, two sharp pieces of composite ripped through the still-forming bubble and into her. The ejection computer compensated as best it could, pulling the bubble tighter and attempting to seal the holes. It was partially successful, although the smaller bubble was not able to slow the pilot's uncontrolled rush through the air. Sensing the ground was coming up quickly, the computer judged that the least risky of several very bad options was to retract the bubble and reform the nanofabric as a parachute. At first, it was a small drogue parachute, used only to slow the pilot's speed through the air. When the computer decided it was safe, it spread the nanofabric out to its full extent. That was the only way to prevent the pilot from hitting the treetops at full speed. Unfortunately, the excessive speed and prior damage to the nanofabric meant the parachute immediately began to rip from the edge to the center. The computer attempted to compensate, and it was still working on knitting together the rip when Saley hit the treetops. The computer knew from talking with the medical status computer implanted in Saley that the pilot was seriously injured and bleeding, but the ejection computer could do nothing to assist the nano-based medical systems inside Saley's body. Saley crashed down through the trees, nearly breaking her back on a thick tree limb. She came to rest, tangled in branches and parachute cords, 12 meters off the ground. Acting on the medical computer's advice, the ejection computer decided not to try untangling the cords. It would be best, according to the medical computer, if the pilot did not move again while medical nanobots were working furiously to save her life. She hung upside down from a tree, unconscious, as machines too small to see tried their best to keep her life from slipping away. For Derek, coming back to consciousness was not a single event, but a lengthy process. He awakened 4 or 5 times before realizing that he was awake, that he was Derek, and that he hurt like hell all over. Then he remembered what had happened. Considering that he had been in a supersonic aircraft when it exploded around him, he decided that he shouldn't complain about some aches and pains, assuming that was all he had to worry about. Moving very slowly, he first tried to wiggle his toes, which was successful. Moving upward, he determined he was able to sit up, but when he tried to push himself up with his left hand, his shoulder flared in a white-hot shock of pain. Oh yeah, he thought. That arm had been out of position when the cockpit separated. If his arm was broken, that could be a big problem. He was able to stand, and painful testing by raising his left arm gave him confidence that nothing was broken. There might be a sprain or torn cartilage. Nothing the Ruhar couldn't fix if he could get to a hamster medical facility, and if they would consent to treat a human, and if they had equipment modified for human biology. Satisfied that he was mobile, he searched the pockets of his flight suit. He had a knife, a light, and a Z-phone. No sidearm, because humans were not allowed to have weapons. No food. Damn it. He was on a planet where he couldn't eat any of the native life or any of the crops the Ruhar grew on the continent of Tenturo, and his Z-phone wasn't working. It couldn't connect to the network. The network appeared to be down entirely. The Krestang could be jamming it, or they had knocked out the base infrastructure, or the Ruhar had simply cut off network access for humans once the fighting started, so he couldn't call for help. The map function did work. Where the hell was he? Not good. He was in the middle of nowhere. The closest Ruhar settlement was 4 or 5 days of hard walking at least. 4 days of walking through the wilderness, without food, to a Ruhar village that would not have any human food and likely would not welcome a human wandering into their homes. They especially would not welcome a human while the Ruhar on Paradise were engaged in a war with the patrons of humanity.
Derek, he said to himself, you are totally screwed.
Before he started walking, he needed to see if he could find Saley. Her locator beacon would not be active until air search and rescue pinged it, so he couldn't use it to find her. Which direction to start? It didn't matter. The Ruhar pilot could be anywhere, although she should be within a kilometer or two. The paraglider should have steered her toward a safe landing zone, although according to the map, there weren't any. He would need to walk in one direction for a kilometer, then begin a grid search. He decided to begin by walking uphill. That way, the return would be easier.